mind. This was not art for art's sake, but art for the sake of sanity. One of the attractions of life in the base, and on the moon as a whole, was undoubtedly the low gravity, which produced a sense of general well-being. However, this had its dangers, and it was several weeks before an emigrant from Earth could adapt to it. On the moon, the human body had to learn a whole new set of reflexes. It had, for the first time, to distinguish between mass and weight. A man who weighed 180 pounds on Earth might be delighted to discover that he weighed only 30 pounds on the moon. As long as he moved in a straight line at a uniform speed, he felt a wonderful sense of buoyancy. But as soon as he attempted to change course, to turn corners, or to stop suddenly, then he would find that his full 180 pounds of mass, or inertia, was still there. For that was fixed and unalterable, the same on Earth, moon, sun, or in free space. Before one could be properly adapted to lunar living, therefore, it was essential to learn that all objects were now six times as sluggish as their mere weight would suggest. It was a lesson usually driven home by numerous collisions and hard knocks, and old lunar hands kept their distance from newcomers until they were acclimatized. With its complex of workshops, offices, storerooms, computer center, generators, garage, kitchen, laboratories, and food processing plant, Clavius Base was a miniature world in itself. And ironically, many of the skills that had been used to build this underground empire had been developed during the half-century of the Cold War. Any man who had ever worked in a hardened missile site would have felt at home in Clavius. Here on the moon were the same arts and hardware of underground living and of protection against a hostile environment. But here they had been turned to the purposes of peace. After 10,000 years, man had at last found something as exciting as war. Unfortunately, not all nations had yet realized that fact. The mountains that had been so prominent just before landing had mysteriously disappeared, hidden from sight below the steeply curving lunar horizon. Around the spacecraft was a flat, gray plain, brilliantly lit by the slanting Earthlight. Although the sky was, of course, completely black, only the brighter stars and planets could be seen, unless the eyes were shaded from the surface glare. Several very odd vehicles were rolling up to the Ares-1B spaceship. Cranes, hoists, servicing trucks, some automatic, some operated by a driver in a small pressure cabin. Most of them moved on balloon tires, for this smooth, level plane posed no transportation difficulties. But one tanker rolled on the peculiar flex wheels, which had proved one of the best all-purpose ways of getting around on the moon. A series of flat plates arranged in a circle, each plate independently mounted and sprung, the flex wheel had many of the advantages of the caterpillar track from which it had evolved. It would adapt its shape and diameter to the terrain over which it was moving, and, unlike a caterpillar track, would continue to function even if a few sections were missing. A small bus with an extension tube like a stubby elephant trunk was now nuzzling affectionately up against the spacecraft. A few seconds later, there were bangings and bumpings from outside, followed by the sound of hissing air as connections were made and pressure was equalized. The inner door of the airlock opened, and the welcoming delegation entered. It was led by Ralph Halverson, the administrator of the southern province, which meant not only the base but also any exploring parties that operated from it. With him was his chief scientist, Dr. Roy Michaels, a grizzled little geophysicist whom Floyd knew from previous visits, and half a dozen senior scientists and executives. They greeted him with respectful relief. From the administrator downward, it was obvious that they looked forward to a chance of unloading some of their worries.
"Very pleased to have you with us, Dr. Floyd," said Halverson. "Did you have a good trip?"
"Excellent," Floyd answered. "It couldn't have been better. The crew looked after me very well." He exchanged the usual small talk that courtesy demanded while the bus rolled away from the spacecraft. By unspoken agreement, no one mentioned the reason for his visit. After traveling 1,000 feet from the landing site, the bus came to a large sign which read, "Welcome to Clavius Base, U.S. Astronautical Engineering Corps, 1994. It then dived into a cutting which took it quickly below ground level. A massive door opened ahead, then closed behind them. This happened again, and yet a third time. When the last door had closed, there was a great roaring of air, and they were back in atmosphere once more, in the shirt-sleeve environment of the base. After a short walk through a tunnel packed with pipes and cables and echoing hollowly with rhythmic thumpings and throbbings, they arrived in executive territory, and Floyd found himself back in the familiar environment of typewriters, office computers, girl assistants, wall charts, and ringing telephones. As they paused outside the door labeled Administrator, Halverson said diplomatically,
"Dr. Floyd and I will be along to the briefing room in a couple of minutes."
The others nodded, made agreeable sounds, and drifted off down the corridor. But before Halverson could usher Floyd into his office, there was an interruption. The door opened, and a small figure hurled itself at the Administrator.
"Daddy, you've been topside, and you promised to take me."
"Now, Diana," said Halverson with exasperated tenderness, "I only said I'd take you if I could. But I've been very busy meeting Dr. Floyd. Shake hands with him. He's just come from Earth."
The little girl, Floyd judged that she was about 8, extended a limp hand. Her face was vaguely familiar, and Floyd suddenly became aware that the Administrator was looking at him with a quizzical smile. With a shock of recollection, he understood why.
"I don't believe it," he exclaimed. "When I was here last, she was just a baby."
"She had her 4th birthday last week," Halverson answered proudly. "Children grow fast in this low gravity, but they don't age so quickly. They'll live longer than we do."
Floyd stared in fascination at the self-assured little lady, noting the graceful carriage and the unusually delicate bone structure.
"It's nice to meet you again, Diana," he said.
Then something, perhaps sheer curiosity, perhaps politeness, impelled him to add,
"Would you like to go to Earth?"
Her eyes widened with astonishment. Then she shook her head.
"It's a nasty place. You hurt yourself when you fall down. Besides, there are too many people."
So here, Floyd told himself, is the first generation of the space-born. There would be more of them in the years to come. Though there was sadness in this thought, there was also a great hope. When Earth was tamed and tranquil, and perhaps a little tired, there would still be scope for those who loved freedom, for the tough pioneers, the restless adventurers. But their tools would not be axe and gun and canoe and wagon. They would be nuclear power plant and plasma drive and hydroponic farm. The time was fast approaching when Earth, like all mothers, must say farewell to her children. With a mixture of threats and promises, Halverson managed to evict his determined offspring and led Floyd into the office. The Administrator's suite was only about 15 feet square, but it managed to contain all the fittings and status symbols of the typical $50,000-a-year head of a department. Signed photographs of important politicians, including the President of the United States and the Secretary General of the United Nations, adorned one wall, while signed photos of celebrated astronauts covered most of another. Floyd sank into a comfortable leather chair and was given a glass of sherry, courtesy of the Lunar Biochemical Labs.
"How's it going, Ralph?"
Floyd asked, sipping the drink with caution, then with approval.
"Not too bad," Halverson replied. "However, there is something you'd better know about before you go in there."
"What is it?"
"Well, I suppose you could describe it as a morale problem," Halverson sighed.
"Oh?"
"It isn't serious yet, but it's getting there fast."
"The news blackout," Floyd said flatly.
"Right," Halverson replied. "My people are getting very steamed up about it. After all, most of them have families back on Earth. They probably believe they're all dead of moon plague."
"I'm sorry about that," said Floyd, "but no one could think of a better cover story, and so far it's worked. By the way, I met Moisevich at the space station, and even he bought it."
"Well, that should make security happy."
"Not too happy. He had heard of TMA-1. Rumors are beginning to leak out. But we just can't issue any statement until we know what the damn thing is and whether our Chinese friends are behind it."
"Dr. Michaels thinks he has the answer to that. He's dying to tell you."
Floyd drained his glass.
"And I'm dying to hear him. Let's go."
Chapter 11. Anomaly. The briefing took place in a large rectangular chamber that could hold 100 people with ease. It was equipped with the latest optical and electronic displays and would have looked like a model conference room but for the numerous posters, pin-ups, notices, and amateur paintings, which indicated that it was also the center of the local cultural life. Floyd was particularly struck by a collection of signs, obviously assembled with loving care, which carried such messages as, "Please keep off the grass,"
No parking on even days. Defense defumer. To the beach. Cattle crossing. Soft shoulders and do not feed the animals. If these were genuine, as they certainly appeared to be, their transportation from Earth had cost a small fortune. There was a touching defiance about them. On this hostile world, men could still joke about the things they had been forced to leave behind, and which their children would never miss. A crowd of 40 or 50 people was waiting for Floyd, and everyone rose politely as he entered behind the administrator. As he nodded at several familiar faces, Floyd whispered to Halverson, "I'd like to say a few words before the briefing." Floyd sat down in the front row while the administrator ascended the rostrum and looked round his audience.
"Ladies and gentlemen," Halverson began, "I needn't tell you that this is a very important occasion. We are delighted to have Dr. Heywood Floyd with us. We all know him by reputation, and many of us are acquainted with him personally. He has just completed a special flight from Earth to be here, and before the briefing he has a few words for us, Dr. Floyd."
Floyd walked to the rostrum amid a sprinkling of polite applause, surveyed the audience with a smile, and said, "Thank you. I only want to say this. The President has asked me to convey his appreciation of your outstanding work, which we hope the world will soon be able to recognize. I'm quite aware," he continued carefully, "that some of you, perhaps most of you, are anxious that the present veil of secrecy be withdrawn. You would not be scientists if you thought otherwise." He caught a glimpse of Dr. Michaels, whose face was creased in a slight frown which brought out a long scar down his right cheek, presumably the aftermath of some accident in space. The geologist, he was well aware, had been protesting vigorously against what he called this cops and robbers nonsense. "But I would remind you," Floyd continued, "that this is a quite extraordinary situation. We must be absolutely sure of our own facts. If we make errors now, there may be no second chance. So please be patient a little longer. Those are also the wishes of the President." "That's all I have to say. Now I'm ready for your report." He walked back to his seat. The administrator said,
"Thank you very much, Dr. Floyd,"
and nodded rather brusquely to his chief scientist. On cue, Dr. Michaels walked up to the rostrum, and the lights faded out. A photograph of the moon flashed onto the screen. At the very center of the disk was a brilliant white crater ring from which a striking pattern of rays fanned out. It looked exactly as if someone had hurled a bag of flour at the face of the moon, and it had spattered out in all directions.
"This is Tycho," said Michaels, pointing to the central crater. "On this vertical photograph, Tycho is even more conspicuous than when seen from Earth. Then it's rather near the edge of the moon. But observed from this viewpoint, looking straight down from 1,000 miles up, you'll see how it dominates an entire hemisphere."
He let Floyd absorb this unfamiliar view of a familiar object, then continued,
"During the past year, we have been conducting a magnetic survey of the region from a low-level satellite. It was completed only last month, and this is the result, the map that started all the trouble."
Another picture flashed on the screen. It looked like a contour map, though it showed magnetic intensity, not heights above sea level. For the most part, the lines were roughly parallel and spaced well apart, but in one corner of the map, they became suddenly packed together to form a series of concentric circles, like a drawing of a knothole in a piece of wood. Even to an untrained eye, it was obvious that something peculiar had happened to the moon's magnetic field in this region, and in large letters across the bottom of the map were the words, "Tycho Magnetic Anomaly 1, TMA-1. Stamped on the top right was classified.
"At first we thought it might be an outcrop of magnetic rock, but all the geological evidence was against it, and not even a big nickel-iron meteorite could produce a field as intense as this, so we decided to have a look. The first party discovered nothing, just the usual level terrain, buried beneath a very thin layer of moon dust. They sank a drill in the exact center of the magnetic field to get a core sample for study. 20 feet down, the drill stopped. So the survey party started to dig. Not an easy job in spacesuits, as I can assure you. What they found brought them back to base in a hurry. We sent out a bigger team with better equipment. They excavated for 2 weeks, with the result you know."
The darkened assembly room became suddenly hushed and expectant as the picture on the screen changed. Though everyone had seen it many times, there was not a person who failed to crane forward as if hoping to find new details. On Earth and Moon, less than 100 people had so far been allowed to set eyes on this photograph. It showed a man in a bright red and yellow spacesuit standing at the bottom of an excavation and supporting a surveyor's rod marked off in tenths of a meter. It was obviously a night shot and might have been taken anywhere on the Moon or Mars, but until now no planet had ever produced a scene like this. The object before which the spacesuited man was posing was a vertical slab of jet-black material, about 10 feet high and 5 feet wide. It reminded Floyd somewhat ominously of a giant tombstone. Perfectly sharp-edged and symmetrical, it was so black it seemed to have swallowed up the light falling upon it. There was no surface detail at all. It was impossible to tell whether it was made of stone or metal or plastic or some material altogether unknown to man.
TMA-1, Dr. Michaels declared, almost reverently. It looks brand new, doesn't it? I can hardly blame those who thought it was just a few years old and tried to connect it with the third Chinese expedition back in 98, but I never believed that, and now we've been able to date it positively from local geological evidence. My colleagues and I, Dr. Floyd, will stake our reputations on this. TMA-1 has nothing to do with the Chinese. Indeed, it has nothing to do with the human race, for when it was buried, there were no humans. You see, it is approximately 3 million years old. What you are now looking at is the first evidence of intelligent life beyond the Earth.
Chapter 12. Journey by Earthlight. Macro Crater Province extends south from near center of visible face of moon east of Central Crater Province, densely packed with impact craters, many large and including the largest on moon. In north, some craters fractured from impact forming Mare Imbrium. Rough surfaces almost everywhere except for some crater bottoms. Most surfaces in slopes, mostly 10 degrees to 12 degrees. Some crater bottoms nearly level. Landing and movement. Landing generally difficult because of rough sloping surfaces, less difficult in some level crater bottoms. Movement possible almost everywhere, but route selection required, less difficult on some level crater bottoms. Construction. Generally moderately difficult because of slope and numerous large blocks in loose material. Excavation of lava difficult in some crater bottoms. Tycho. Post Maria Crater. 54 miles diameter, rim 7,900 feet above surroundings, bottom 12,000 feet deep, has the most prominent ray system on the moon, some rays extending more than 500 miles. Extract from Engineer Special Study of the Surface of the Moon, Office Chief of Engineers, Department of the Army, U.S. Geological Survey, Washington, 1961. The mobile lab now rolling across the crater plain at 50 miles an hour looked rather like an outsized trailer mounted on 8 flex wheels. But it was very much more than this. It was a self-contained base in which 20 men could live and work for several weeks. Indeed, it was virtually a land-going spaceship, and in an emergency it could even fly. If it came to a crevasse or canyon which was too large to detour and too steep to enter, it could hop across the obstacle on its 4 underjets. As he peered out of the window, Floyd could see stretching ahead of him a well-defined trail where dozens of vehicles had left a hard-packed band in the friable surface of the moon. At regular intervals along the track were tall, slender rods, each carrying a flashing light. No one could possibly get lost on the 200-mile journey from Clavius Base to TMA-1, even though it was still night and the sun would not rise for several hours. The stars overhead were only a little brighter, or more numerous, than on a clear night from the high plateaus of New Mexico or Colorado. But there were two things in that coal-black sky that destroyed any illusion of Earth. The first was Earth itself, a blazing beacon hanging above the northern horizon. The light pouring down from the giant half-globe was dozens of times more brilliant than the full moon, and it covered all this land with a cold, blue-green phosphorescence. The second celestial apparition was a faint, pearly cone of light slanting up the eastern sky. It became brighter and brighter toward the horizon, hinting of great fires just concealed below the edge of the moon. Here was a pale glory that no man had ever seen from Earth, save during the few moments of a total eclipse. It was the corona, harbinger of the lunar dawn, giving notice that before long the sun would smite this sleeping land. As he sat with Halverson and Michaels in the forward observation lounge, immediately beneath the driver's position, Floyd found his thoughts turning again and again to the 3-million-year-wide gulf that had just opened up before him. Like all scientifically literate men, he was used to considering far longer periods of time, but they had concerned only the movements of stars and the slow cycles of the inanimate universe. Mind or intelligence had not been involved. Those eons were empty of all that touched the emotions.
3 million years!
The infinitely crowded panorama of written history, with its empires and its kings, its triumphs and its tragedies, covered barely 1/1000th of this appalling span of time. Not only man himself, but most of the animals now alive on Earth did not even exist when this black enigma was so carefully buried here, in the most brilliant and most spectacular of all the craters of the moon. That it had been buried, and quite deliberately, Dr. Michaels was absolutely sure.
"At first," he explained, "I rather hoped it might mark the site of some underground structure, but our latest excavations have eliminated that. It's sitting on a wide platform of the same black material, with undisturbed rock beneath it. The creatures who designed it wanted to make sure it stayed put, barring major moonquakes. They were building for eternity."
There was triumph and yet sadness in Michael's voice, and Floyd could share both emotions. At last, one of man's oldest questions had been answered. Here was the proof, beyond all shadow of doubt, that his was not the only intelligence that the universe had brought forth. But with that knowledge there came again an aching awareness of the immensity of time. Whatever had passed this way had missed mankind by 100,000 generations. Perhaps, Floyd told himself, it was just as well. And yet, what we might have learned from creatures who could cross space while our ancestors were still living in trees. A few hundred yards ahead, a signpost was coming up over the moon's strangely close horizon. At its base was a tent-shaped structure covered with shining silver foil, obviously for protection against the fierce heat of day. As the bus rolled by, Floyd was able to read in the brilliant earthlight, "Emergency Depot Number 3, 20 kilos locks, 10 kilos water, 20 food packs, MK4, 1 toolkit Type B, 1 suit repair outfit, telephone."
"Have you thought of that?" asked Floyd, pointing out of the window. "Suppose the thing's a supply cache, left behind by an expedition that never returned."
"It's a possibility," admitted Michaels. "That magnetic field certainly labeled its position so that it could be easily found, but it's rather small. It couldn't hold much in the way of supplies."
"Why not?" interjected Halverson. "Who knows how big they were? Perhaps they were only 6 inches tall, which would make the thing 20 or 30 stories high."
Michaels shook his head.
"Out of the question," he protested. "You can't have very small, intelligent creatures. You need a minimum brain size."
Michaels and Halverson, Floyd had noticed, usually took opposing viewpoints. Yet there appeared to be little personal hostility or friction between them. They seemed to respect each other and simply agreed to disagree. There was certainly little agreement anywhere about the nature of TMA-1, or the Tycho Monolith, as some preferred to call it, retaining part of the abbreviation. In the 6 hours since he had landed on the moon, Floyd had heard a dozen theories, but had committed himself to none. Shrine, survey marker, tomb, geophysical instrument, these were perhaps the favorite suggestions, and some of the protagonists grew very heated in their defense. A good many bets had already been placed, and a lot of money would change hands when the truth was finally known, if indeed it ever was. So far, the hard, black material of the slab had resisted all the rather mild attempts that Michaels and his colleagues had made to obtain samples. They had no doubt that a laser beam would cut into it, for surely nothing could resist that frightful concentration of energy. But the decision to employ such violent measures would be left to Floyd. He had already decided that X-rays, sonic probes, neutron beams, and all other non-destructive means of investigation would be brought into play before he called up the heavy artillery of the laser. It was the mark of a barbarian to destroy something one could not understand. But perhaps men were barbarians, beside the creatures who had made this thing. And where could they have come from? The moon itself? No, that was utterly impossible. If there had ever been indigenous life on this barren world, it had been destroyed during the last crater-forming epoch, when most of the lunar surface was white-hot. Earth? Very unlikely, though perhaps not quite impossible. Any advanced terrestrial civilization, presumably a non-human one, back in the Pleistocene era, would have left many other traces of its existence. We would have known all about it, thought Floyd, long before we got to the moon. That left two alternatives, the planets and the stars. Yet all the evidence was against intelligent life elsewhere in the solar system, or indeed life of any kind except on Earth and Mars. The inner planets were too hot, the outer ones far too cold, unless one descended into their atmosphere to depths where the pressures amounted to hundreds of tons to the square inch. So perhaps these visitors had come from the stars. Yet that was even more incredible. As he looked up at the constellations strewn across the ebon lunar sky, Floyd remembered how often his fellow scientists had proved that interstellar travel was impossible. The journey from Earth to Moon was still fairly impressive, but the very nearest star was 100 million times more distant. Speculation was a waste of time. He must wait until there was more evidence.
Please fasten your seat belts and secure all loose objects. 40-degree slope approaching.
Two marker posts with winking lights had appeared on the horizon, and the bus was steering between them. Floyd had barely adjusted his straps when the vehicle slowly edged itself over the brink of a really terrifying incline and began to descend a long, rubble-covered slope as steep as the roof of a house. The slanting earthlight, coming from behind them, now gave very little illumination, and the bus's own floodlights had been switched on. Many years ago, Floyd had stood on the lip of Vesuvius, staring into the crater. He could easily imagine that he was now driving down into it, and the sensation was not a very pleasant one. They were descending one of the inner terraces of Tycho, and it leveled out again some 1,000 feet below. As they crawled down the slope, Michaels pointed out across the great expanse of plain now spread out beneath them.
"There they are!" he exclaimed.
Floyd nodded. He had already noticed the cluster of red and green lights several miles ahead, and kept his eyes fixed upon it as the bus edged its way delicately down the slope.
This is the end of Disc 2. Please continue listening on Disc number 3. This is Disc number 3.
"There they are,"
he exclaimed. Floyd nodded. He had already noticed the cluster of red and green lights several miles ahead, and kept his eyes fixed upon it as the bus edged its way delicately down the slope. The big vehicle was obviously under perfect control, but he did not breathe easily until it was once more on an even keel. Now he could see, glistening like silver bubbles in the earthlight, a group of pressure domes, the temporary shelters housing the workers on the site. Near these were a radio tower, a drilling rig, a group of parked vehicles, and a large pile of broken rock, presumably the material that had been excavated to reveal the monolith. This tiny camp in the wilderness looked very lonely, very vulnerable to the forces of nature ranged silently around it. There was no sign of life, and no visible hint as to why men had come here so far from home.
"You can just see the crater," said Michaels. "Over there on the right, about 100 yards from that radio antenna."
"So this is it," thought Floyd, as the bus rolled past the pressure domes and came to the lip of the crater. His pulse quickened as he craned forward for a better view. The vehicle began to creep cautiously down a ramp of hard-packed rock into the interior of the crater, and there, exactly as he had seen it in the photographs, was TMA-1. Floyd stared, blinked, shook his head, and stared again. Even in the brilliant earthlight, it was hard to see the object clearly.
His first impression was of a flat rectangle that might have been cut out of carbon paper. It seemed to have no thickness at all. Of course, this was an optical illusion. Though he was looking at a solid body, it reflected so little light that he could see it only in silhouette. The passengers were utterly silent as the bus descended into the crater. There was awe, and there was also incredulity, sheer disbelief that the dead moon of all worlds could have sprung this fantastic surprise. The bus came to a halt within 20 feet of the slab and broadside on so that all the passengers could examine it. Yet, beyond the geometrically perfect shape of the thing, there was little to see. Nowhere were there any marks or any abatement of its ultimate ebon blackness. It was the very crystallization of night, and for one moment Floyd wondered if it could indeed be some extraordinary natural formation born of the fires and pressures attending the creation of the moon. But that remote possibility, he knew, had already been examined and dismissed. At some signal, floodlights around the lip of the crater were switched on, and the bright earthlight was obliterated by a far more brilliant glare. In the lunar vacuum, the beams were, of course, completely invisible. They formed overlapping ellipses of blinding white, centered on the monolith, and where they touched it, its ebon surface seemed to swallow them. Pandora's box, thought Floyd, with a sudden sense of foreboding, waiting to be opened by inquisitive man. And what will he find inside? Chapter 13. The Slow Dawn. The main pressure dome at the TMA-1 site was only 20 feet across, and its interior was uncomfortably crowded. The bus, coupled to it through one of the two airlocks, gave some much-appreciated extra living room. Inside this hemispherical, double-walled balloon lived, worked, and slept the 6 scientists and technicians now permanently attached to the project. It also contained most of their equipment and instruments, all the stores that could not be left in the vacuum outside, cooking, washing, and toilet facilities, geological samples, and a small TV screen through which the site could be kept under continuous surveillance. Floyd was not surprised when Halverson elected to remain in the dome. He stated his views with admirable frankness.
"I regard spacesuits as a necessary evil," said the administrator. "I wear one 4 times a year for my quarterly checkout tests. If you don't mind, I'll sit here and watch over the TV."
Some of this prejudice was now unjustified, for the latest models were infinitely more comfortable than the clumsy suits of armor worn by the first lunar explorers. They could be put on in less than a minute, even without help, and were quite automatic. The MK-5, into which Floyd was now carefully sealed, would protect him from the worst that the moon could do, either by day or by night. Accompanied by Dr. Michaels, he walked into the small airlock. As the throbbing of the pumps died away and his suit stiffened almost imperceptibly around him, he felt himself enclosed in the silence of vacuum. That silence was broken by the welcome sound of his suit radio.
"Pressure okay, Dr. Floyd? Are you breathing normally?"
"Yes, I'm fine."
His companion carefully checked the dials and gauges on the outside of Floyd's suit. Then he said,
"Okay, let's go."
The outer door opened, and the dusty moonscape lay before them, glimmering in the earthlight. With a cautious, waddling movement, Floyd followed Michaels through the lock. It was not hard to walk. Indeed, in a paradoxical way, the suit made him feel more at home than at any time since reaching the moon. Its extra weight and the slight resistance it imposed on his motion gave some of the illusion of the lost terrestrial gravity. The scene had changed since the party had arrived barely an hour ago. Though the stars and the half-Earth were still as bright as ever, the 14-day lunar night had almost ended. The glow of the corona was like a false moonrise along the eastern sky, and then, without warning, the tip of the radio mast 100 feet above Floyd's head suddenly seemed to burst into flame as it caught the first rays of the hidden sun. They waited while the project supervisor and 2 of his assistants emerged from the airlock, then walked slowly toward the crater. By the time they had reached it, a thin bow of unbearable incandescence had thrust itself above the eastern horizon. Though it would take more than an hour for the sun to clear the edge of the slowly turning moon, the stars were already banished. The crater was still in shadow, but the floodlights mounted around its rim lit the interior brilliantly. As Floyd walked slowly down the ramp toward the black rectangle, he felt a sense not only of awe, but of helplessness. Here, at the very portals of Earth, man was already face to face with a mystery that might never be solved. 3 million years ago, something had passed this way, had left this unknown and perhaps unknowable symbol of its purpose, and had returned to the planets, or to the stars. Floyd's suit radio interrupted his reverie.
Project supervisor speaking. If you'd all line up on this side, we'd like to take a few photos. Dr. Floyd, will you stand in the middle? Dr. Michaels, thank you.
No one except Floyd seemed to think that there was anything funny about this. In all honesty, he had to admit that he was glad someone had brought a camera. Here was a photo that would undoubtedly be historic, and he wanted copies for himself. He hoped that his face would be clearly visible through the helmet of the suit.
Thanks, gentlemen,
said the photographer after they had posed somewhat self-consciously in front of the monolith and he had made a dozen exposures.
We'll ask the base photo section to send you copies.
Then Floyd turned his full attention to the ebon slab, walking slowly around it, examining it from every angle, trying to imprint its strangeness upon his mind. He did not expect to find anything, for he knew that every square inch had already been gone over with microscopic care. Now, the sluggish sun had lifted itself above the edge of the crater, and its rays were pouring almost broadside upon the eastern face of the block, yet it seemed to absorb every particle of light as if it had never been. Floyd decided to try a simple experiment. He stood between the monolith and the sun and looked for his own shadow on the smooth black sheet. There was no trace of it. At least 10 kilowatts of raw heat must be falling on the slab. If there was anything inside, it must be rapidly cooking. How strange, Floyd thought, to stand here while this thing is seeing daylight for the first time since the ice ages began on Earth. He wondered again about its black color. That was ideal, of course, for absorbing solar energy. But he dismissed the thought at once, for who would be crazy enough to bury a sun-powered device 20 feet underground? He looked up at the Earth, beginning to wane in the morning sky. Only a handful of the 6 billion people there knew of this discovery. How would the world react to the news when it was finally released? The political and social implications were immense. Every person of real intelligence, everyone who looked an inch beyond his nose, would find his life, his values, his philosophy subtly changed. Even if nothing whatsoever was discovered about TMA-1 and it remained an eternal mystery, man would know that he was not unique in the universe. Though he had missed them by millions of years, those who had once stood here might yet return. And if not, there might well be others. All futures must now contain this possibility. Floyd was still musing over these thoughts when his helmet speaker suddenly emitted a piercing electronic shriek like a hideously overloaded and distorted time signal. Involuntarily, he tried to block his ears with his space-suited hands. Then he recovered and groped frantically for the gain control of his receiver. While he was still fumbling, 4 more of the shrieks blasted out of the ether. Then there was a merciful silence. All around the crater, figures were standing in attitudes of paralyzed astonishment. "So it's nothing wrong with my gear," Floyd told himself. Everyone heard those piercing electronic screams. After 3 million years of darkness, TMA-1 had greeted the lunar dawn. Chapter 14. The Listeners. 100 million miles beyond Mars, in the cold loneliness where no man had yet traveled, Deep Space Monitor 79 drifted slowly among the tangled orbits of the asteroids. For 3 years it had fulfilled its mission flawlessly, a tribute to the American scientists who had designed it, the British engineers who had built it, the Russian technicians who had launched it. A delicate spiderweb of antennas sampled the passing waves of radio noise, the ceaseless crackle and hiss of what Pascal, in a far simpler age, had naively called the silence of infinite space. radiation detectors noted and analyzed incoming cosmic rays from the galaxy and points beyond. Neutron and X-ray telescopes kept watch on strange stars that no human eye would ever see. Magnetometers observed the gusts and hurricanes of the solar winds as the sun breathed million-mile-an-hour blasts of tenuous plasma into the faces of its circling children. All these things, and many others, were patiently noted by Deep Space Monitor 79 and recorded in its crystalline memory. One of its antennas, by now unconsidered miracles of electronics, was always aimed at a point never far from the sun. Every few months its distant target could have been seen, had there been any eye here to watch, as a bright star with a close, fainter companion, but most of the time it was lost in the solar glare. To that far-off planet Earth, every 24 hours, the monitor would send the information it had patiently garnered, packed neatly into 1 5-minute pulse. About a quarter of an hour later, traveling at the speed of light, that pulse would reach its destination. The machines whose duty it was would be waiting for it. They would amplify and record the signal and add it to the thousands of miles of magnetic tape now stored in the vaults of the World Space Centers at Washington, Moscow, and Canberra. Since the first satellites had orbited, almost 50 years earlier, trillions and quadrillions of pulses of information had been pouring down from space to be stored against the day when they might contribute to the advance of knowledge. Only a minute fraction of all this raw material would ever be processed, but there was no way of telling what observations some scientist might wish to consult 10 or 50 or 100 years from now. So everything had to be kept on file, stacked in endless air-conditioned galleries, triplicated at the 3 centers against the possibility of accidental loss. It was part of the real treasure of mankind, more valuable than all the gold locked uselessly away in bank vaults. And now Deep Space Monitor 79 had noted something strange, a faint yet unmistakable disturbance rippling across the solar system, and quite unlike any natural phenomenon it had ever observed in the past. Automatically, it recorded the direction, the time, the intensity. In a few hours, it would pass the information to Earth. As, also, would Orbiter M15, circling Mars twice a day, and High Inclination Probe 21 climbing slowly above the plane of the ecliptic, and even Artificial Comet 5 heading out into the cold wastes beyond Pluto along an orbit whose far point it would not reach for 1,000 years, all noted the peculiar burst of energy that had disturbed their instruments, all, in due course, reported back automatically to the memory stores on distant Earth. The computers might never have perceived the connection between 4 peculiar sets of signals from space probes on independent orbits millions of miles apart, but as soon as he glanced at his morning report, the radiation forecaster at Goddard knew that something strange had passed through the solar system during the last 24 hours. He had only part of its track, but when the computer projected it on the planet's situation board, it was as clear and unmistakable as a vapor trail across a cloudless sky, or a single line of footprints over a field of virgin snow, some immaterial pattern of energy, throwing off a spray of radiation like the wake of a racing speedboat, had leaped from the face of the moon and was heading out toward the stars. Part 3. Between Planets. Chapter 15. Discovery. The ship was still only 30 days from Earth, yet David Bowman sometimes found it hard to believe that he had ever known any other existence than the closed little world of Discovery. All his years of training, all his earlier missions to the Moon and Mars, seemed to belong to another man in another life. Frank Poole admitted to the same feelings, and had sometimes jokingly regretted that the nearest psychiatrist was the better part of 100 million miles away. But this sense of isolation and estrangement was easy enough to understand, and certainly indicated no abnormality. In the 50 years since men had ventured into space, there had never been a mission quite like this. It had begun, 5 years ago, as Project Jupiter, the first manned round trip to the greatest of the planets. The ship was nearly ready for the 2-year voyage when, somewhat abruptly, the mission profile had been changed. Discovery would still go to Jupiter, but she would not stop there. She would not even slacken speed as she raced through the far-ranging Jovian satellite system. On the contrary, she would use the gravitational field of the giant world as a sling to cast her even farther from the sun. Like a comet, she would streak on across the outer reaches of the solar system to her ultimate goal, the ringed glory of Saturn. And she would never return. For Discovery, it would be a one-way trip. Yet her crew had no intention of committing suicide. If all went well, they would be back on Earth within 7 years, 5 of which would pass like a flash in the dreamless sleep of hibernation while they awaited rescue by the still unbuilt Discovery 2. The word rescue was carefully avoided in all of the Astronautics Agency's statements and documents. It implied some failure of planning, and the approved jargon was reacquisition. If anything went really wrong, there would certainly be no hope of rescue, almost a billion miles from Earth. It was a calculated risk, like all voyages into the unknown. But half a century of research had proved that artificially induced human hibernation was perfectly safe, and it had opened up new possibilities in space travel. Not until this mission, however, had they been exploited to the utmost. The three members of the survey team, who would not be needed until the ship entered her final orbit around Saturn, would sleep through the entire outward flight. Tons of food and other expendables would thus be saved. Almost as important, the team would be fresh and alert and not fatigued by the 10-month voyage when they went into action. Discovery would enter a parking orbit around Saturn, becoming a new moon of the giant planet. She would swing back and forth along a 2-million-mile ellipse that took her close to Saturn and then across the orbits of all its major moons. They would have 100 days in which to map and study a world with 80 times the area of Earth and surrounded by a retinue of at least 15 known satellites, one of them as large as the planet Mercury. There must be wonders enough here for centuries of study. The first expedition could only carry out a preliminary reconnaissance. All that it found would be radioed back to Earth. Even if the explorers never returned, their discoveries would not be lost. At the end of the 100 days, Discovery would close down. All the crew would go into hibernation. Only the essential systems would continue to operate, watched over by the ship's tireless electronic brain. She would continue to swing around Saturn, on an orbit now so well determined that men would know exactly where to look for her 1,000 years hence. But in only 5 years, according to present plans, Discovery 2 would come. Even if 6 or 7 or 8 years elapsed, her sleeping passengers would never know the difference. For all of them, the clock would have stopped as it had stopped already for Whitehead, Kaminsky, and Hunter. Sometimes Bowman, as first captain of Discovery, envied his 3 unconscious colleagues in the frozen peace of the hibernaculum. They were free from all boredom and all responsibility. Until they reached Saturn, the external world did not exist. But that world was watching them through their biosensor displays. Tucked inconspicuously away among the massed instrumentation of the control deck were 5 small panels marked Hunter, Whitehead, Kaminsky, Poole, Bowman. The last 2 were blank and lifeless. Their time would not come until a year from now. The others bore constellations of tiny green lights, announcing that everything was well, and on each was a small display screen across which sets of glowing lines traced the leisurely rhythms that indicated pulse, respiration, and brain activity. There were times when Bowman, well aware how unnecessary this was, for the alarm would sound instantly if anything was wrong, would switch over to audio output. He would listen half-hypnotized to the infinitely slow heartbeats of his sleeping colleagues, keeping his eyes fixed on the sluggish waves that marched in synchronism across the screen. Most fascinating of all were the EEG displays, the electronic signatures of 3 personalities that had once existed and would one day exist again. They were almost free from the spikes and valleys, the electrical explosions that marked the activity of the waking brain, or even of the brain in normal sleep. If there was any wisp of consciousness remaining, it was beyond the reach of instruments and of memory. This last fact Bowman knew from personal experience. Before he was chosen for this mission, his reactions to hibernation had been tested. He was not sure whether he had lost a week of his life or whether he had postponed his eventual death by the same amount of time. When the electrodes had been attached to his forehead and the sleep generator had started to pulse, he had seen a brief display of kaleidoscopic patterns and drifting stars. Then they had faded and darkness had engulfed him. He had never felt the injections, still less the first touch of cold as his body temperature was reduced to only a few degrees above freezing. He awoke, and it seemed that he had scarcely closed his eyes. But he knew that was an illusion. Somehow, he was convinced that years had really passed. Had the mission been completed? Had they already reached Saturn, carried out their survey, and gone into hibernation? Was Discovery 2 here to take them back to Earth? He lay in a dreamlike daze, utterly unable to distinguish between real and false memories. He opened his eyes, but there was little to see except a blurred constellation of lights which puzzled him for some minutes. Then he realized that he was looking at the indicator lamps on a ship situation board, but it was impossible to focus on them. He soon gave up the attempt. Warm air was blowing across him, removing the chill from his limbs. There was quiet, but stimulating, music welling from a speaker behind his head. It was slowly growing louder and louder. Then a relaxed, friendly, but he knew, computer-generated, voice spoke to him.
"You are becoming operational, Dave. Do not get up or attempt any violent movements. Do not try to speak."
Do not get up, thought Bowman. That was funny. He doubted if he could wriggle a finger. Rather to his surprise, he found that he could. He felt quite contented, in a dazed, stupid kind of way. He knew dimly that the rescue ship must have come, that the automatic revival sequence had been triggered, and that soon he would be seeing other human beings. That was fine, but he did not get excited about it. Presently, he felt hunger. The computer, of course, had anticipated this need.
"There is a signal button by your right hand, Dave. If you are hungry, please press it."
Bowman forced his fingers to hunt around and presently discovered the pear-shaped bulb. He had forgotten all about it, though he must have known it was there. How much else had he forgotten? Did hibernation erase memory? He pressed the button and waited. Several minutes later, a metal arm moved out from the bunk and a plastic nipple descended toward his lips. He sucked on it eagerly, and a warm, sweet fluid coursed down his throat, bringing renewed strength with every drop. Presently it went away, and he rested once more. He could move his arms and legs now. The thought of walking was no longer an impossible dream. Though he felt his strength swiftly returning, he would have been content to lie here forever if there had been no further stimulus from outside. But presently another voice spoke to him, and this time it was wholly human, not a construct of electrical pulses assembled by a more-than-human memory. It was also a familiar voice, though it was some time before he could recognize it.
"Hello, Dave. You're coming around fine. You can talk now. Do you know where you are?"
He worried about this for some time. If he was really orbiting Saturn, what had happened during all the months since he had left Earth? Again, he began to wonder if he was suffering from amnesia. Paradoxically, that very thought reassured him. If he could remember the word amnesia, his brain must be in fairly good shape. But he still did not know where he was, and the speaker at the other end of the circuit must have understood his situation completely.
"Don't worry, Dave. This is Frank Poole. I'm watching your heart and respiration. Everything is perfectly normal. Just relax. Take it easy. We're going to open the door now and pull you out."
Soft light flooded into the chamber. He saw moving shapes silhouetted against the widening entrance, and in that moment all his memories came back to him, and he knew exactly where he was. Though he had come back safely from the furthest borders of sleep and the nearest borders of death, he had been gone only a week. When he left the hibernaculum, he would not see the cold Saturnian sky. That was more than a year in the future and a billion miles away. He was still in the trainer at the Houston Space Flight Center, under the hot Texas sun. Chapter 16. Hal. But now, Texas was invisible, and even the United States was hard to see. Though the low-thrust plasma drive had long since been closed down, Discovery was still coasting with her slender, arrow-like body pointed away from Earth, and all her high-powered optical gear was oriented toward the outer planets, where her destiny lay. There was one telescope, however, that was permanently aimed at Earth. It was mounted like a gun sight on the rim of the ship's long-range antenna, and checked that the great parabolic bowl was rigidly locked upon its distant target. While Earth remained centered in the crosswires, the vital communication link was intact, and messages could come and go along the invisible beam that lengthened more than 2 million miles with every day that passed. At least once in every watch period, Bowman would look homeward through the antenna alignment telescope. As Earth was now far back toward the sun, its darkened hemisphere faced discovery, and on the central display screen the planet appeared as a dazzling silver crescent, like another Venus. It was rare that any geographical features could be identified in that ever-shrinking arc of light, for cloud and haze concealed them. But even the darkened portion of the disk was endlessly fascinating. It was sprinkled with shining cities. Sometimes they burned with a steady light, sometimes they twinkled like fireflies as atmospheric tremors passed over them. There were also periods when, as the moon swung back and forth in its orbit, it shone down like a great lamp upon the darkened seas and continents of Earth. Then, with a thrill of recognition, Bowman could often glimpse familiar coastlines shining in that spectral lunar light. And sometimes, when the Pacific was calm, he could even see the moon glow shimmering across its face, and he would remember nights beneath the palm trees of tropical lagoons. Yet he had no regrets for these lost beauties. He had enjoyed them all in his 35 years of life, and he was determined to enjoy them again when he returned, rich and famous. Meanwhile, distance made them all the more precious. The sixth member of the crew cared for none of these things, for it was not human. It was the highly advanced HAL 9000 computer, the brain and nervous system of the ship. HAL, for capital H, heuristically programmed capital AL algorithmic computer, no less, was a masterwork of the third computer breakthrough. These seemed to occur at intervals of 20 years, and the thought that another one was now imminent already worried a great many people. The first had been in the 1940s, when the long obsolete vacuum tube had made possible such clumsy, high-speed morons as ENIAC and its successors. Then in the 1960s, solid-state microelectronics had been perfected. With its advent, it was clear that artificial intelligences, at least as powerful as man's, need be no larger than office desks, if one only knew how to construct them. Probably no one would ever know this. It did not matter. In the 1980s, Minsky and Good had shown how neural networks could be generated automatically, self-replicated, in accordance with an arbitrary learning program. Artificial brains could be grown by a process strikingly analogous to the development of a human brain. In any given case, the precise details would never be known, and even if they were, they would be millions of times too complex for human understanding. Whatever way it worked, the final result was a machine intelligence that could reproduce, some philosophers still preferred to use the word mimic, most of the activities of the human brain, and with far greater speed and reliability. It was extremely expensive, and only a few units of the HAL 9000 series had yet been built, but the old jest that it would always be easier to make organic brains by unskilled labor was beginning to sound a little hollow. HAL had been trained for this mission as thoroughly as his human colleagues, and at many times their rate of input, for in addition to his intrinsic speed, he never slept. His prime task was to monitor the life support systems, continually checking oxygen pressure, temperature, hull leakage, radiation, and all the other interlocking factors upon which the lives of the fragile human cargo depended. He could carry out the intricate navigational corrections and execute the necessary flight maneuvers when it was time to change course, and he could watch over the hibernators, making any necessary adjustments to their environment and doling out the minute quantities of intravenous fluids that kept them alive. The first generations of computers had received their inputs through glorified typewriter keyboards and had replied through high-speed printers and visual displays. HAL could do this when necessary, but most of his communication with his shipmates was by means of the spoken word. Poole and Bowman could talk to HAL as if he were a human being, and he would reply in the perfect idiomatic English he had learned during the fleeting weeks of his electronic childhood. Whether HAL could actually think was a question which had been settled by the British mathematician Alan Turing back in the 1940s. Turing had pointed out that if one could carry out a prolonged conversation with a machine, whether by typewriter or microphones, was immaterial, without being able to distinguish between its replies and those that a man might give, then the machine was thinking by any sensible definition of the word. Hal could pass the Turing test with ease. The time might even come when Hal would take command of the ship. In an emergency, if no one answered his signals, he would attempt to wake the sleeping members of the crew by electrical